listening to a Drishti Point podcast. Please visit our website for more inspiring interviews on yoga, spirituality, and wellness. Welcome, Padma. It's great to have you here on Drishti Point.
Thanks, Farah. Nice to be here.
I thought I'd start off by asking a little bit about you and your background and your study and the classes that you give.
Sure. Well, what would you like to know about my background?
Where you teach about meditation and yoga philosophy, and I'm wondering where you've studied and how you've studied and what is the lineage or the teacher that you have been studying with.
Right. Well, I actually, just on my travels, ended up in the northwest Himalayas of India. And originally I'd planned just to stay for the summertime, and it turned into a year, then 2 years, then it turned into 7 years, and then 9 years. So I spent a long time in the Himalayas with a meditation master up there. There's a small group of people studying with him. And it's in a classical Vedant tantric lineage. And it's basically, I learned the depth of meditation and all of the philosophy which supports meditation and, you know, educates the mind to understand the various subtle states of meditation.
Now, you teach meditation, you teach meditation as related to coming from a yoga lineage, which is quite unusual because here in North America, often yoga is understood to be just a physical practice and understood to be the asanas. It's very rare to go to a yoga class and practice meditation.
Well, there's just simply a different meaning to the word in North America. In North America, yes, people think the word yoga means the yoga exercises. But in India, the word yoga doesn't mean that. It actually means something quite different. The word yoga is a series of practices, including meditation and philosophy and action in the world, devotion, all kinds of different styles of practice of yoga, not just exercising. And also yoga, the word means really the final state of perfection of a person, the final state of clarity of mind, of no more suffering, no more troubles, a state of pure clarity. That actually is what yoga means. So it's just become different. I mean, I didn't know what was going on in North America when I was in the Himalayas, and it was very interesting. I was flying back on the airplane, and I picked up a magazine on the airplane, and there was a whole spread about yoga in Hollywood and all these Hollywood stars doing yoga poses, and it just seemed so alien. It just didn't seem like anything to do with the depths of study I'd been doing in the Himalayas.
Now, today we're going to talk about what you teach in one of your courses, which is about the foundations for meditation. And that includes the yamas and niyamas, which come from Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Can you tell us, just give us a broad introduction to what the yamas and niyamas are?
Well, this Patanjali Yoga Sutras is a book that was written about 2,500 years ago, and it kind of lays down the foundations of yoga philosophy and wisdom. It doesn't refer to the exercises very much. I think in one sutra it mentions exercising. Other than that, it's really a book of yoga psychology and philosophy and metaphysics. So it's more to do with what yoga means in India than here in North America, because here in North America the attention is on the physical exercises. So Patanjali Yoga Sutras is really a book of classical yoga as taught, you know, in the old lineage, in the Indian lineage. And in there, Patanjali lays out 8 kind of classical steps of practice that a yogi undertakes in a lifetime. And the very first 2 are called yam and niyam. And these are like the foundation of your morals and ethics and behavior. So in a way, Patanjali says, before you even go on to any other practices of yoga to advance your awareness, to advance your refined sensibility, before that you have to actually watch your behavior in the world and watch how you interact with other people. So the yams and niyams, the yams particularly, are a lot of how you behave in the world. And the niyams actually are a list of practices you do personally, like your own discipline that you do yourself for your own practice.
And I know from our own series that we've done before, we did a series on the yam and niyam, and the first one was ahimsa, which I think I would say many people are familiar with the concept of non-harm. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the different layers of ahimsa and what it means.
Well, the very first injunction in the very first step of classical yoga, as if like number one of number one, is ahimsa. So when Patanjali was laying out the classical eightfold steps, in the first step there are five different categories, and the very first step is ahimsa. And I believe that this is because ahimsa is really the foundational ethic of yoga. Ahimsa really is the foundational practice of yoga. So it's the practice and the ethic, and it's also, I believe, the foundational result of your yoga practice. So after having practiced and practicing nonviolence, the result of that practice will be the unfoldment of a state of nonviolence in yourself and in the world. So I think the very first word, ahimsa, is very profound, because it lays down the foundation for why we're doing our practice at all. And it lays down that kind of one rule of what you make your decisions based on. So as a yogi, you always ask yourself, is this creating harm or is this not creating harm? It's always the first ethic.
It seems to me that, you could spend a lifetime just perfecting that.
Well, exactly. And as I say, it's the first one of the first step, and it's ultimately profound, and you really could just stop there and practice ahimsa, and that does permeate all of the rest of the eight limbs of classical yoga for sure. And like I say, right to the very end of the eighth limb, ultimately it kind of comes full circle around, and where you end up at the end of your practice is in a state of ahimsa, a state of pure nonviolence, pure love, pure oneness, and awareness of never harming life. So it really is the beginning, the middle, and the end of yoga practice.
When we practice ahimsa, is it, do we practice, how do we practice, in the sense that is it that we just become aware and we ask that question in our actions and in our thoughts and in our words, and that helps to cultivate that quality in us?
Yeah, exactly. Becoming aware of the levels of where violence can occur, right? Firstly, of course, in the physical body and with each other, it's very obvious that we don't harm each other, hit each other. Mm-hmm. That's pretty blatantly obvious, right? A yogi doesn't go around hitting people. And so physical nonviolence is fundamental, mm-hmm. and to not do that is basic, right? Then, of course, you become aware of your speech. I mean, what we say has so much power in it. It's like every time you say a word, you're sending out this amazing power. And if the quality of that is harming, then really that's a subtle sense of violence. So to be watchful, mm-hmm. of the quality of the words. And so when you speak, are your words carrying love? Are your words carrying a sense of oneness? Not just in their content, but in their tone and intention. Mm-hmm. Are you speaking from a sense of duality and arrogance, or are you speaking with a sense of inclusion and oneness? So to really watch our speech is a great practice of ahimsa. Mm-hmm. And then I would say another way is even subtler, is to watch your own mind's thinking. So now you're watching your own thoughts in your own head, and you think nobody else can see them or hear them, so you can go ahead and think negative thoughts. But in fact, that does radiate out from you. That sense, if you're walking around thinking negatively about other people, about the world, about society, or even about your relationships, or even about your own personal self, that negativity is going to be perceived in the world. So in a way, you are creating a subtle violence in the world just by thinking negatively. And also you're creating a sense of violence towards yourself. So yogis practice not only creating violence in the world, but also not creating violence towards themselves. And that's why we take care to eat good food.
I was just going to ask you that, because I know that some interpretations of ahimsa include recommendations for a vegetarian diet.
Absolutely, and that is the foundation, foundational reason for vegetarian diet on an ethical basis, is just simply not killing life if necessary. So if we can exist as vegetarians and be super healthy, which we can, I mean, I've been a vegetarian for 20 years. And it's possible to be strong and healthy and be vegetarian. So if it's possible, then that would be the way to go as a yogi, because that's the least violence creating. Right? So that's again on the body level. You don't create violence to others and you don't create it to yourself.
It seems to me that underlying the concept of ahimsa is also a love that develops when you have a love towards other things or other creatures or other people or to yourself, that it's just a natural outcome that you wouldn't harm.
Well, that's exactly it. That's what I was saying, that as you practice ahimsa, it's basically practicing not wanting to hurt anything ever. And so really that practice alone is cultivating your sense of love, and the result of that will be a natural unfoldment of more love. That's the beautiful part. If when you practice as much love as you can, then even more love unfolds and comes to you.
Beautiful. So much wisdom just in the very first of the very first steps on the yogic path.
Amazing.
We're going to take a break and listen to some music, and when we return, we'll continue with our interview with Padma. Welcome back, Padma. Those of you who just tuned in, you're listening to Drishti Point on Vancouver Cooperative Radio 102.7 FM. This is the first in our series on Padma meditation, and we're talking about the foundations of meditation, and specifically the concept of ahimsa, which comes from the sutras based on the yam and niyam. Padma, let's talk a little bit more about the others of the yam and niyams, and see what else we can start to understand about the importance of a firm foundation for a meditation practice.
Sure, we can do that. Well, the first step of yogic practice is called yam, and there are five components of that. There's ahimsa satya aste brahmacharyana parigraha. And so ahimsa is that very, very first step, and as we were saying, that's the practice and the unfoldment of awareness of nonviolence and oneness. And I said that really is the foundational practice of yoga, and the purpose and intention of your yoga practice, whatever your practice is. So whether your practice is is physical hatha yoga, whether your practice is just meditating, maybe your practice is studying the scriptures, or maybe your practice is simply caring for people in the world, or maybe your practice is simply chanting and being devotional to God. You know, like there's very, very many different ways you can practice and be a yogi. And in all of them, ahimsa is the foundational ethic and the reason for that. And then it goes on, and in that first limb, the yamas, the next one is satya. After ahimsa is satya, which means truth. Sat is the root, which means truth. It also means existence.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost is the sense of what really is, what truly exists. And so satya is, again, the same as ahimsa. It's a practice. We try to always discern what is real, what is true, what's actually going on, and what truly exists, using our intellect, using our awareness. And the result of that continuing practice will be the awareness of that satya, of that truth, of what really is,
so,
as opposed to, you know.
So when we practice being truthful in our thoughts and in our words and in our interactions in life, then we come to see truth, to experience truth. Or
that's right. That's right. And so then it becomes an ongoing practice of what is true, right? And that becomes, we go through different phases of understanding of this. First, it's just what you believe is true, what you think is true, and our concept of that. And it becomes more and more refined to understanding the sense of actually what truly exists. And
that's a very subtle and abstract level of truth as to what truly exists, because you know, in yoga philosophy and Vedanta, it's often talked about the concept of maya or illusion. And I think satya is very much related to that. Can you talk a little bit about that subtle level of understanding of satya?
Sure. The like I said, the root of sat means existence. And so so the yogis take that kind of discernment of what is true and not true, refine it right down to the level of pure existence, what actually is existing and what is transient. And ultimately it comes down to a discernment of what is permanent and what is changing. So that becomes the final discernment of true versus what's defined as not true. So in a say, what is changing and always always in transition is considered changing. That's all there is to it. It's not a negative that it's untrue. It's just considered changing versus what is always constant.
Which is why I suppose the physical realm in yoga is referred to mrityam loka, the world of change.
That's right. It's simply discerning that. What is changing and what is unchanging? And that's not something that normally people even think about, as far as, you know, maybe they have a rough idea of some things being more solid than others or more permanent than other things. And the yogis really explore that right down to the basis of what is the most permanent, what is the most unchanging foundation of being versus everything else, which is in a state of flux, a state of transition. And it's not considered a negative, or it's not a good or a bad. It's not one's better than the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an understanding, a clarity of understanding what is changing versus what is unchanging. And that's the sense of satya, is just knowing what is going on and without judgment.
And what is, would that be what is referred to as atma, or...
Well, I believe it's both. I mean, the unchanging and the changing are both existent, but it's understanding the truth of that. It's understanding that unchanging is, and changing is, but it is changing. And so it's that super clarity of knowing, okay, this is, but it's changing.
Uh-huh, I see. So, like, almost like coming to know the nature of Prakriti and Purusha, like just
that's
that.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
The changing field versus the unchanging, and a continuing exploration of that is a large part of subtle yoga work, right? Of understanding the changing world. And so, as people practice their hatha yoga exercises, right, they're getting to know their physical body. They're getting to know their changing physical body, which is a positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's better to be in touch with your body than not.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, they'll find out that that body is changing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And ultimately, eventually, if they're an introspective person, they'll start to question on what about me then is not changing. If my body, even if it's super fit and I can do, you know, amazing yoga poses, even then it's still changing.
Mm-hmm.
Then what about me is not changing? What about me is eternally present, always at this moment present?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of more spiritual introspection that some people come to want to know about.
Mm-hmm. So, ahimsa, satya.
Going on to the third one, aste.
Uh-huh.
Right? Aste literally means not stealing. Aste is not stealing. So, in a way, it's obvious. Like, you don't go, you know, into a go shoplifting. It's clear, right? But if you take, again, it's all of these yamas can be taken on a very obvious level or taken subtler and subtler. So aste, not stealing on a subtler level, you can start to explore what does that mean. And it can mean even not stealing other people's time, being aware of other people's property, but also of their time, also of their energy and their emotions, not being, you know, an energy kind of sucker.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I look at aste as really being the quality of respect. I've always mm-hmm. thought of aste just simply the awareness of respect. You don't take other people's things or time or energy. You don't take what's not yours. You don't take more than you need to survive, and you certainly don't take what other people consider theirs
mm-hmm.
or what they need. So it's a kind of respect for the whole. Everybody needs something, and respecting that.
I've heard also an interpretation of asteya as cultivating a quality of generosity.
Well, that would be, yes, exactly, not taking. I mean, you could say that you're giving back, but I think purely the word asteya literally just means not taking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it means that you're allowed to exist fully. It doesn't mean that you're supposed to not take what you need. Right, it's like not that you're supposed to live in some kind of austerity and abstinence that's going to now harm your life.
Aha! Uh-huh. So right? I see what that means also on a very subtle level of existing in this world, not, and I guess this is also related to aparigraha, mm-hmm. not taking more than what you need to live comfortably in.
Yes, but also not taking less than you need. I mean, I think not stealing means that it doesn't say you don't have enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's I believe it's saying that to be comfortable in the world yourself and do know that you also need food, you also need shelter, you know, like to actually be okay with that,
mm-hmm.
to take care of yourself, but to allow others the same.
Mm-hmm.
So generosity towards yourself as well.
Mm-hmm.
Generosity towards others, but and not a sense of just purely not taking based in greed. It's a kind of an antidote for greed, for the sense of not having enough. Some people are basically, they kind of walk around like hungry ghosts. You know, they're always in need. They're always craving more, more, more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so astay is an injunction basically to antidote or contradict that tendency.
Mm-hmm.
And to build the power of not needing more, so that you cannot need more. Right? Then you can take freely whatever comes along and is offered to you, but you're not needing.
And now, the next one is brahmacharya,
mm-hmm.
brahmachar, and that I've seen several different interpretations of.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about your understanding of what that means.
Well, Brahm is God, right? Brahm is the word for God.
Mm-hmm.
And charya means to carry. To
mm-hmm.
carry. So it literally means carrying God with you. And I believe this is carrying God with you in all of your actions. So the carrying is an action.
Mm-hmm.
Again, these are the first steps of yoga. So it's talking about action in the world. It's talking about your attitudes and relationships and societal interactions. on one level. And brahmacharya is that always having that presence of God in your actions. So whatever you're doing, you are carrying the awareness of God in that, in yourself and in the world and in other people. Whoever you might be interacting with, you're aware of the God which is present in them.
That's so interesting. It's so interrelated, because you would think that a godly person, someone who carries that concept with them, would naturally, their actions would be guided by ahimsa and satya.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and all of these really are. That's why I say they all come back basically to ahimsa, or any of them could be, you know, the one they come back to.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're also foundational. They're all saying the same thing from a different perspective,
right?
Different facet.
Mm-hmm.
So brahmacharya really doesn't disclude any actions. It simply says whatever actions you do, be aware that you're acting with awareness of God in you and with the other. And then there's that again. It comes back to that respect. Comes back to that sense of what truly exists here.
Mm-hmm.
Versus what our concept might be. You know, say you're with another person, are you truly with that person? Are you truly aware of who that person is? Or are you seeing them through your concept of who they are, your idea of objectifying them? Right? So that brahmacharya is always seeing the God in somebody.
That's a very profound act.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful, very beautiful. And before we go on our break, let's talk about the last of the aparigraha.
The fifth one is aparigraha, which grahan is the Sanskrit root for to grasp. So aparigraha means non-grasping. So non-grasping is, again, not that greediness, not that neediness to clutch onto, as if you're people who feel less. People who feel below, they need something, they're in need of something, they'll be grasping on to something, trying hard to feel fulfilled. And so there really is, it comes from a sense of not knowing your own true self and searching desperately to try to find that. So then that becomes this eternal seeking of who am I, what do I need, and grasping on to everything. So aparigraha means practice not grasping and find out who you really are.
And this, that grasping, I guess, reminds me of in Buddhism the term craving, and the term attachment, that it seems very much related to that concept of holding, trying.
That's right. It is attachment, and it's that sense of... something comes, and instead of just being with it and allowing it to pass, instead you grab onto it. And that could be some material object, you know, it could be a television or a car, could even be a person or some situation, right? You grasp onto that, and you say, this is mine, this is my thing, this is my person, this is my situation. Even subtler than that, you grasp onto thoughts, you know, this
and
is
memories.
My opinion, and my memories. These are my opinions, right? This is who I am. So it's that grasping onto a sense of identity. And like I said, it comes from not knowing who you are. So therefore, you're grasping out, reaching, trying to find something to identify yourself onto.
Mm-hmm.
And so the antidote to non-grasping is to remember who you truly are. And then that grasping is unnecessary.
Well, this is lots of food for thought. Let's, on that note, take a short break and listen to some music. And when we come back, we'll continue. Welcome back, Padma. It's wonderful to have you here on Drishti Point. And we have a little bit of time now to talk about another aspect of creating a foundation for a meditation practice. And that is the niyam, or the... the personal practices. Yeah, the niyam.
Yeah, that's right. The second limb of classical classical yoga, you have the eight limbs that Patanjali laid down as the eight steps or the eight limbs of practice. The second one is called niyam, and they really are personal practices to develop, to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first one, I believe, is again the foundational one of them. It's shaucha, which means purification. So in a way, the foundations of our practice are all in order to simply purify on the physical level, on the emotional level, on the mental level, and spiritually and mentally. So just simply to remove obstacles to clarity. That's what purify means.
Mm-hmm. So purifying our thoughts, purifying our actions, purifying our, I guess, the subtle levels of our existence.
Exactly. And again, it comes, it goes through many levels. At first, you have a concept of what purify means, as if it's maybe something like, you know, virtuous or something like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we go through many concepts of understanding. Shauch, which translates as purify or purity or purification, I don't believe it's a kind of a moral or ethical judgment. It's not like something is more pure or less pure.
Mm-hmm.
It's more matter of fact than that. I think this Patanjali is very practical. It's very just foundational, what works. So what is considered not pure, it's not a moral judgment. It's just what doesn't allow you to be happy, what doesn't allow you to be clear, what doesn't allow you to see oneness, what doesn't allow you to feel that total connection with oneness, with life. So those obstacles that come in are called non-purity.
Uh-huh.
See, it's not a moral judgment, just a really practical, like actual obstacles in your path. Say your physical body, if you don't eat well, you don't exercise well, then you probably spend most of your time paying attention and concerned with your physical health.
Right.
So now you've just taken away a lot of time for meditating. You're so busy taking care of your physical health that you have no more time left to meditate. So in a way, that becomes an obstacle, right? If you cultivate constantly good health through eating and exercising and good sleep and all these great things, your body will function better, and that will be purified then. You won't need to spend all of your time focused only on that. The same thing with the mind, though, too. If your mind is full of negative emotions, negative thinking, negative accusations or blame or judgment or anger or whatever it might be, we tend to spend all of our time then focusing on that,
mm-hmm.
right? Those kinds of obstacles in the mind field, it's considered, take our attention. They draw our attention. So now you're not thinking clearly, you're not thinking of purity, you're not thinking of oneness, you're totally distracted thinking of those mental obstacles.
And I can see what you mean when you say saucha is not about purity in a moral sense, but about purity in a sense of awareness of oneness sense.
Exactly. So the purification is really removing obstacles to your own happiness and clarity and expanded awareness. Whatever constricts you, whatever makes you feel diminished or makes you feel less or needy or not in connection with life,
mm-hmm.
that's an obstacle. Right? And so to recognize that and to be able to use your yoga practice, your exercising, your breath work, chanting, meditating, all of your yoga skills,
mm-hmm.
are meant for you to use to help you clear those obstacles once you've recognized them.
And now, are there specific recommendations for practices in the rest of the niyams to help purify?
Well, the very second one, after shaucha, is santosh, which is contentment. Right? Contentment. And again, it's the same thing. It can be taken as the practice, and it can be taken as the middle of the practice, and it can be taken as the very end result of the practice. Santosha means contentment. And it is the final result. You know, once you've practiced and practiced for years, you will feel this amazing, like, sense of contentment and love in your heart with no effort whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so we begin with practicing intentionally. So Santosha starts out as an intentional practice of being content.
Which means that we cultivate that from within and don't find necessarily that outside of ourselves, which also I think seems to relate very much to satya and existence and
mm-hmm.
truth.
That's right, exactly. So Santosha is really knowing your own true being, right? Knowing your own essence and having clarity of that vision. So Santosha is contentment, and so it's recognizing when you feel discontent.
Mm-hmm.
If you notice that I'm feeling like I really need that thing, I need that person, I need that situation, and you feel that discontent in yourself,
mm-hmm.
that's when you become aware, like, oh, that's discontent, right? That's all it is. It's not even the thing itself. It's just a sense of discontent in me, right, manifesting in this need to go buy that red car, whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know? So you recognize where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And then you practice in yourself, you know what, maybe I don't need to feel that discontent. Maybe I can remember my own pure essence
mm-hmm.
and go meditate on that for a while and reconnect with that pure eternal essence in my being. And then that discontent actually dissolves.
That's interesting. It reminds me of that aphorism, enjoy everything, need nothing.
Yeah, it's like that's kind of the final result of all our practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're in the state of not needing anything, you can enjoy everything. It's so fantastic.
We're starting to come to the end of our time, but I know there's a few others that we should talk about before we end.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Niyam has five levels as well. So Shauch, Santosha, and then the last three, Taps, Vadyay, and Ishwar Pranidhan. And these three actually comprise what's called Kriya Yoga. Tapa, Swadhyay, and Ishwar Pranidhan are how really to do yoga. So Patanjali here really sums up all of the practice of being a yogi. Tapa is all the efforts we make, all the work we do, all the things we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
becoming aware, doing meditation, practicing breath work, doing exercising. All of this stuff is the effort we make, and that's, he recommends, yes, you do have to make effort.
Mm-hmm.
You do have to try to make effort in order to do the purification of Shaucha.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The second thing is Swadhyay, which is self-study. Swa is the self, and Dhyay literally means the intellect. So studying yourself is all these things we've been talking about, being very aware.
Mm-hmm. The introspection and contemplation of how we act in the world.
Yes, and noticing what's driving our behavior and noticing when we're discontent or when we're unsatisfied, just really being clear about recognizing those motivators.
Mm-hmm.
So Swadhyay is understanding your own ego mechanism and how you are in the world. Yeah, it's watching how you behave and watching what's really making me do or think or want this.
Mm-hmm.
So efforts, self-study, and the third part of Kriya Yoga is Ishwar Pranidhan, which literally means surrendering to God. And I like this one, I like to think of this one as just pure meditation. So there's efforts you make, there's intellectual study, and then there's just simply pure meditation. And those are the three foundational practices of Kriya Yoga, of doing yoga. So Ishwar Pranidhan is simply sitting in meditation and not doing anything. It's the practice of not doing anything at all. Right? You've done all your tapa, all your efforts, and you've done all your intellectualization and all your self-psychological studies. And now you're just going to sit in meditation and absolutely surrender it all and have just a total openness that life itself is present and will support you and will come forth if you allow it to.
You know, that reminds me of an excerpt from a book, Patanjali Yog Darshan by Swami Sham. And it's there's such a beautiful description of meditation. He says, one must just sit in stillness. No effort, no coercion, nothing. And he said, you continue that practice for a number of years until you reach the state of nirodha, or the state where there's no thoughts, the state of just pure existence or awareness. And it, I think it's the most beautiful and simple explanation of meditation I've ever seen.
It is right on target. It's just simply dropping all your efforts, dropping all your ego, dropping all your sense of personal doership or accomplishment or control, and really just totally letting go of all those edges, all of those ideas, and finding that the faith and the trust to let go and know that the space itself will become present and your awareness will become clear. And you will totally be brought into the space of awareness by itself. It happens naturally. If you let go of control and ego, then basically God is there present waiting for you already.
That's a beautiful, beautiful thought.
It's an amazing text of awareness. Patanjali Yoga Sutras, like I said before, it's not a textbook of doing yoga exercises at all. It's a text that describes practices and all the subtle states you go through and the nuances as you go through your practice over years. It's a book really more of meditation and philosophy than physical exercise. And it unfolds a clarity of awareness, which is called yoga. The word yoga really means oneness. It means awareness of oneness. And so that state of clarity unfolds in the consciousness after all these practices and purifications.
I'm so glad that you're with us here today and have agreed to do this series with us on Padma meditation. I think it'll be of great benefit to our listeners and to people who practice yoga to understand the different layers and depths of what of texts like the sutras have to offer people who practice yoga.
So I hope so.
Thank you so much for being with us today, and I look forward to our next interview in this series.
Thank you very much, Farah. It's been a delight. I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Okay. So that. Thank you for listening to Drishti Point. We dedicate our efforts to the health and happiness of our listeners and for the health and happiness of all living beings.